Hey, hello, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.com. PRN.FM is another way to reach us. The phone number here is 888-874-4888. Free call, 888-874-4888. We're talking Occupy. We're talking about the spring offensive that we've been told is on its way, that once the weather changes, Occupy will come out of its hibernation over the course of the winter, and all these people will emerge better rested and more determined than ever to try to bring about change and justice in America for the 99% as opposed to the 1% who remain very much in charge. We have a panel of experts here, activists, occupiers, who are involved deeply in this movement, who are going to share ideas with us. Hopefully, we're going to debate some of those ideas as well. In the second half hour, Paul McIsaac of Playback Theater is going to join us. He's been working on a video basically about the history of nonviolence and about how nonviolence is a tool that social movements have used successfully to defeat powerful forces. So we're going to hear from him as well. We're talking Occupy today on News Dissector Radio because everybody's talking about Occupy. It's in the news every day, and it's also in our heads, i.e., what's going to happen now? Can this movement really achieve its goals? So we're going to go around. I'm going to ask everybody in this room, just very briefly, introduce yourself and tell us what you've been doing with Occupy. Let's start with the G-man to my right.
Hey, I'm Goldie. I've been down at Occupy since September 17th, 2011. Causing general mayhem, and then we formed into some groups, and I'm in a few of those groups doing a few good things, and I'm going to pass the mic.
Hey, I'm Catherine. I've been down there since the first day, September 17th. I have not slept there, but I am there all the time. I mean, thank God I'm in a position right now that I don't have to sleep there, but I'm at every single march. I believe in Occupy Wall Street. I've been waiting for it to come along for a very long time.
Yes, and I, too, have been waiting for it my whole life. And my name is Priya, sometimes known as War Crime, an independent journalist covering Occupy since the very beginning. And I'm also organizing the Anarchist Film Festival in New York City Friday, April 13th, and we'll be showing a lot of Occupy footage, so I hope you can make it.
And my name is Christina Gonzalez. I'm a lifelong New Yorker. I've been with Occupy Wall Street since day two. I've been arrested several times since then. I've been working tirelessly to stop stop and frisk, a policy that's performed by the NYPD, which disproportionately affects Black and Latino males between the ages of 16 and 24 years old. And I think that Occupy is ready to make itself known again.
You know, I was on the subway coming up here, and I think I saw a stop and frisk going on right in front of me. There were a lot of cops on the train on the number one, and this young man was being harassed, showing his ID, et cetera, to two police officers on the train. So this is not an abstraction. This is not a problem that sort of happens somewhere else late at night. This is happening all the time, around the clock here in New York City. There's a big article in the New York Times today.
Yes.
About stop and frisk and about how this issue is perceived differently in many cases by people of color and people who are in power who are not people of color, who don't seem to see how significant and important and pervasive it is in the city of New York. So we're going to get to that. But first, welcome to Occupy on News Dissector Radio.
In the entire planet that are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
This is corrupt!
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game.
This is corrupt!
Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
Yeah, it's a movement moment. That's from a collage by Polarity One. Polarity One is a music maker, music producer, and he's also working with Occupy Now on a radio show. Goldie is part of it. I've contributed to it. So this is an attempt to really create media that's popular, that could reach a larger audience than, you know, the so-called lamestream media, Occupy's own media, that could actually convey both the spirit of Occupy and the message of Occupy. I think that's the basic idea there. I myself, your news dissector, Danny Schechter, have written a book called Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street, which is coming out from Cosimo Books. It's an effort to try to offer some analysis and some sense of kind of chronology here, how this whole thing emerged, how it developed, how after just 6 weeks there were protests in 1,000 cities around the world supporting the whole idea of Occupy, even though that idea often is not very clear to some folks because it doesn't really express itself in a list, you know, of ends or something like that, or message points that like the ones politicians use on MSNBC. It has a different way of expressing its values and ideas. We're going to get into that right now as we talk about Occupy. Spring is here. You know, there's the old song, Dancing in the Streets. It's time for some dancing in the streets. What is happening now? What's going to change with Occupy? It seems like there's a lot of people committed to making this very visible and really to take on issues of importance. Most recently, and this is Christina can tell us about this, there were protests at the police headquarters here in New York, complaints about police brutality, which are very common, but now a demand that the mayor fire Ray Kelly, the police chief. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, we think that Ray Kelly has committed more crimes than any of these young black children that he seems to be allowing to be arrested in the streets. We had a press conference a few days ago, and I mean, there are several people who are calling for his resignation. There's no way that he should be allowed to do this. He is a criminal. And I think it's really funny that his own son was accused of raping a woman, and somehow she was allowed to get away with that as he continues to allow young black kids in the city.
He was allowed to get away with it. Mm. You said she.
I apologize. Yeah, he was allowed to get away with it, you know, and whether this young lady was paid off or, you know, they were able to pull some strings. I mean, I don't see how that's allowed. And he's still allowed to harass these young children in the streets and spy on Muslim communities. Yeah. And
well, the case on about Ray Kelly, of course, is that he's been also involved in this whole surveillance, illegal surveillance program on Muslims not only in New York City, but as far as Connecticut, I don't know where else. In other words, the NYPD has positioned itself almost as a global intelligence operation, second only to maybe to the CIA, with which it works closely. Mm-hmm. So we have a situation of a police environment where repressive laws are increasing today. The New York Times reports this. The Obama administration is moving to relax restrictions on how counterterrorism analysts may retrieve, store, and search information about Americans gathered by government agencies for purposes other than national security threats. Attorney General Eric H. Holder, supposedly the head of the Department of Justice, has signed new guidelines for the National Counterterrorism Center, which was created in 2004 under the Class Bush administration to foster intelligence sharing and serve as a terrorism threat clearinghouse. You'll remember at the time when this project called Total Information Awareness was first announced, there was a tremendous reaction against it, and the Bush administration was forced to withdraw it. Now the Obama administration is reviving it, along with surpassed recently the NDAA, for one, a new law, new executive order about national resources at a time of emergency, and other measures which seem to be tightening the police presence. And I'll be speaking about that as well, because everybody asks, well, what are you and Occupy going to do now? What is the state doing? That's partly what we have to discuss. Goldie, what's your sense of the temperature, the climate around Occupy right now?
I mean, everyone's infuriated because of headlines like this. I mean, I didn't read that article, but I'm sure it's couched in terms that are very passive. And it's that kind of passivity that allows the article to be read and just the average American reads it and they think, okay, that's, you know, something must be going on, but I don't need to be concerned about this. And I don't know how to bring this to people's awareness. I applaud you, Danny, for bringing it on the radio, but it's got to get out there. I mean, these laws that are being passed are really they're really harmful to civil liberties in a supposedly free country. Down at Occupy, we're heating up. The weather's summer. It's summer already in March, mm-hmm. And we're ready to go. We have Union Square right now, a small but fervent occupation. And it just it's beautiful because it the average New Yorker walks by Union Square and they can see what's happening. Unlike at Zuccotti Park, they can see the ridiculous police presence. I mean, we're laying off teachers, we're cutting back like every other service that we really need, but the cops don't get touched. There's 500 cops in riot gear, brand new equipment, vans, surveillance, all this stuff all over the place, and they're just blowing tons of money every night, surveilling 200 or 300. Dirty.
I mean, the other night when I was leaving the Trayvon Martin demonstration in Union Square, which was very impressive because, you know, for the first time, it really showed the degree of anger, you know, in the black community here in New York, with so many people coming out and being part of this and listening to the parents of Trayvon Martin, who were so, you know, both, you know, in so much pain and at the same time so eloquent about how they saw all of this. And they didn't call for retribution, but they did call for justice. And after that march, people walked down 14th Street. The cops seemed to have blown it. They usually are, you know, logistics fanatics, you know, trying to control the movement of people. Somehow they fell down on the job, and people just surged into the streets on 14th Street, and cops started running after them. Get on the sidewalk. So they get on the sidewalk for a minute, then come back into the street. And I watched about 8 policemen arrest somebody for no good reason, as far as I could tell, and slam them up against the car for no good reason. And then as I walked home, I heard the unmistakable sound of sirens, and it was the basic terrorist task force that's been training back and forth in New York, you know, maybe 25, 30 cars to try to show police presence, racing down 7th Avenue towards Union Square. And afterwards, there was an announcement from Occupy, a text calling it ridiculous, which it is what it was, you know. But it seems like the more the police have a, quote, enemy to deal with, the more resources they get in terms of equipment and support, and of course support from this mayor, who, in addition to, you know, trying to provide for public safety in New York, is also explicitly and clearly supporting the Wall Street firms. When this man at Goldman Sachs published an op-ed page piece criticizing Goldman Sachs, His Honor, Michael Bloomberg, went down to Wall Street to Goldman Sachs and made, you know, kissy face with the people there and said, oh, you don't have to pay attention to that. He was only a 12-year executive veteran of Goldman Sachs. You don't have to listen to that. Now I've just read a report of analysts, unnamed, anti-terrorism analysts, who are trying to link Occupy Wall Street to the Earth Liberation Front in California, claiming that the people who are accused of, and in some cases convicted of, burning up some cars there as part of a protest against the destruction of the earth, you know, are somehow inspiring or behind Occupy Wall Street. Priya, how true is that?
You know, first of all, the Earth Liberation Front has always committed some, you know, acts of property destruction and sabotage, but never, ever any threat to actual human life. And occupies its own phenomena to kind of make these parallels and demonize. But this isn't a larger pattern of, like, demonizing dissent as terrorism, criminalizing protest in the media, and making us a target of overt police operations and violence in the street, but also covert operations using informants and things like that. This is a police state, Danny, so it's very important that you're talking about this right now.
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things about the Trayvon Martin case, here's a young man wearing oh, my God, a hoodie, you know, which clearly was a sign of him being part of some terrorist organization. And he gets killed in, quote, self-defense by a member of a neighborhood watch group. Okay, I'm sure it's part of this whole atmosphere of polarization. You know, protests bad, Republicans good. That seems to be the spectrum. Kat, you were going to say.
Well, first, I just wanted to let everybody know that tomorrow, Saturday, noon, so you're going to create anybody to look suspicious so you can have a job.
It brings out a sort of a vigilante attitude among people and hostility against people. Nobody really even knows what they're actually standing up for them. They're standing up for poor people in America. They're standing up for working class people, people who have lost jobs, people who have lost homes. People who have lost hope, you know, and along comes Occupy really trying to take a stand on their behalf, and then they get accused of being terrorists and worse. And I think this is the cycle which, you know, most of our media doesn't do a very good job of making distinctions between, you know, between who's who and what's what. And then you have an incident like the incident in France, and suddenly every synagogue in New York has police outside of it, you know, quote, looking for the danger, the threat. And, you know, so all of this creates a climate of paranoia in the city. And, you know, I think that that is very dangerous because it will lead to more people getting killed, certainly more people getting arrested, certainly the police acting with impunity, attacking people. I mean, Christina, you were telling RT the other day, when it was where I met you, about going to a courtroom and having to have your retina, you know, checked. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's something that I now know that I can deny if I'd like to, which I did when I first came into Central Bookings. But when you're leaving, now you're saying, do I want to deny it? Or do I just want to get out of here? And at that point, I just wanted to get out of there. And I had already submitted to one before I ever knew I could deny it. And now I'm finding out that that's part of their facial recognition technology, where now they can scan through videos or pictures or be taking aerial shots and be able to spot you from your retina eye scan. That is freaky. That seems like, you know, something from a sci-fi movie.
All right, now along.
Can I just quickly add, Danny, about what you're saying before, Danny? Is just it's demonizing protests and protesters is really distracting the American public, and I think this is intentional, from the real threats to their social welfare, to their environment, to their human rights. That's the terrorism that's being committed, and the media is distracting the public.
Well, you hear these occupiers talking. They're very articulate. They're very indignant. They're very angry. They have a lot to say. I'm really happy to have you on the show because it's, you know, you don't really get a chance to go on programs and, you know, convey your own humanity and your own concerns. I mean, you know, having a soundbite, you know, on Pix 11, you know, after somebody accuses you of something, you say it's not true and that's the whole story. You know, this is an attempt to do something a little different. Catherine?
The subway is a place where you get bombarded with paranoia about everybody. I mean, I take pictures of these posters, you know, safeguard your stuff, you know, cell phones and electronic devices, prime targets for thieves, you know, with the NYPD, you know, logo on the side of the poster, but it doesn't say, you know, NYPD steals your liberty, you know, if you try to stand up for yourself. Well, and with the constant bombardment of the, you know, the loudspeaker, you know, if you see something, say something, you know, police have a right to search large containers, and like, they, you know, it's just constant
bombardment.
Well,
presented in terms of public safety. Now, while all this was going on, before all this was going on, the largest theft in the history of the world took place here on Wall Street. Trillions of dollars disappeared. Now, all the cameras in these buildings are pointing out at the people in the street.
Right.
None of them are pointing in at the banksters who are actually wheeling and dealing and scheming and transferring wealth from people to the ordinary people to themselves.
Diversion.
And this is, you know, an example of how come with the 35,000 members of the NYPD, there have been no arrests for financial fraud, for all of the ways in which people have been victimized in these illegal foreclosure schemes and the like. It's state authority, it's federal authority that seems to be acting. The NYPD is too busy chasing a teenager, you know, through Union Square Park. Hello, knock, knock. Can't we do better than that? Now, I have some questions for you guys because we've been talking about this and we're hearing a familiar, if not visible enough, critique of police abuse. I certainly agree that that needs to be shared. I've observed it myself. I've been denouncing it for years. I've been part of it for a long time, back to the days of the civil rights movement where your news dissector here was thrown up against the wall and and dealt with all of this and saw, you know, friends of mine killed on the front lines of the fight for freedom, not only here but in South Africa. So I'm aware of it. It's horrific. You know, just yesterday when we were there, you know, with Trayvon Martin, I don't know if it was yesterday. Was it yesterday? Was it 2 days ago? Okay. I'm losing track of time. You know, it was the anniversary in South Africa. It was called the Sharpeville Massacre. 63 Africans were shot down by the police, triggering, you know, the reaction, which was the growth of the anti-apartheid movement, which took a number of years, but finally toppled apartheid, elected Mandela, changed, you know, a lot of the country. And I think we're going to see a pattern like this here. If this abuse continues the way it is, there's going to be resistance to it and a reaction against it, which in many ways may be more powerful than in other countries because Americans don't like to have their freedoms messed with, you know. And I think the police are, you know, maybe able to push people around now, but they are also, there's going to be, you know, what goes around comes around. There is going to be a reaction to this and an explosive reaction. The danger, though, and this is what I was trying to get at before, is if you make the police the enemy, if the cops are the people who are, you know, the cops love to fight with you. The cops love to arrest you. It's overtime. The New York City, the police department has announced it spent $17 million in overtime for the police in the last few months. The cops love this game. And the problem is when you play the game by their rules and you let them define the issues, what happens is that's what the media covers. You know, the media is already set up to cover when it bleeds, it leads. If there's violence, if there's confrontation, where there's conflict, you know, we're there covering it. I worked at ABC, I worked at CNN. I saw this whole way this works up close and personal. Believe me, it's disgusting, it's distressing. Our number, 888-874-4888. But the danger here is that we ourselves can get seduced into this kind of street fight with the cops and lose, you know, the political thrust of what our movement is about. Goldie, do you agree with me on this? Or?
I mean, yeah, street fighting isn't really the purpose of the movement, but it's I think it's great when people see the ridiculous fights that are going on. And then it's just a matter of connecting the dots to find out where their money is going. I mean, these fights don't need to be happening. It's a nonviolent movement. And all I've seen all week is police chase people down and try to arrest them for the stupidest things. So as long as, like, fear and paranoia are the primary growth industries, we're letting the media not report on what's really happening. What's really happening is a news blackout over Occupy. It's a nonviolent protest. There's usually just a few hundred people when the violence goes down because that's when the cops are completely empowered. The other night at Trayvon Martin march, there were thousands of people, and the police lost. They completely lost control. We retook the bull. The barricades were down. Wherever people wanted to go, they went, and the police had no say in the matter. So the police, they back off when there's, you know, 3,000-plus people in the streets. But when there's a few hundred, that's when they pull out the clubs and start swinging, and no one's around to see it.
I think we know police are not the enemy. I mean, I think most cops want to be decent people, but they're working for the system. The police aren't the enemy right now. They're what's standing in the way of the enemy. And I think it should
they're
be
protecting
our,
the enemy.
Right. Yeah, I think it should be our job to get them to come to our side. That's what I think we should be doing. Street fights are not going to be the way to go. And we know that the way to get people's attention is to show that we are peaceful people. Look at how brutal officers can be. And I don't think everyone can handle that violence for much longer.
But they're treating us like we're the enemy, like we're the enemy enemy combatant, and it's you use the word abuse, Danny. It's a good word to use, and this has become like an abusive relationship. And like any abusive relationship, if it doesn't get better, it tends to get worse. And the American people need to realize that our rights don't exist when we actually try to assert them. And watching the kids be punched and tackled and treated this abusively is extremely disturbing, and it's not being reported in the media.
Just a point of information that I spoke to someone last night who said that the police are being taught that Occupy is their enemy, that Occupy is violent and will be violent against them. They're being taught like completely the opposite of what we're actually doing in the streets. And we need to communicate more with the police and tell them that, you know, we're not enemies, we're not violent. And because I don't know what this program is, but I heard about it from an insider, and it was news to me that the police are being taught all kinds of propaganda that Occupy is their enemy.
Well, let's take on this word communication, because I think it is the key word. We have in the room, you know, people who are extremely articulate and are able to communicate. But yet the big rap against the movement, Occupy movement, is that it's not communicating well. It's not explaining what it's about. It's not reaching many of the 99% in whose name it speaks, because it doesn't have ways of it's having its own media outreach. It seems to be internally focused. And I'm personally, you know, as much as I'm sympathetic to the idea of, you know, the park being a symbol of public space and, you know, taking the park, it seems to me that we want to occupy people's minds. We want to occupy their political focus. We want to occupy the direction they want to move this country in. And I just think that we're getting in our own way sometimes because we're limited by a certain number of tactics that worked well at the beginning but don't seem to be working well now. Do we have an ability to, you know, assess this, become more self-critical, perhaps, and analytical, and think about new strategies? And I've listed a whole bunch of them in a recent article that I've written that I would like to raise in the course of this program. But I find this as a problem because I feel like there are some people who have a knee-jerk reaction. We have a right to the park, therefore we will go to the park. But is that the smartest thing to do?
Well, freedom of assembly should not be taken lightly.
Well, yeah, okay. Let's pursue that. Freedom of assembly should not be taken lightly. But our goal here is not freedom of assembly. Our goal here is to communicate a message about inequality in America, about injustice by the 1%. And it's not simply to create space for ourselves to express ourselves, but a way to get more people involved in expressing themselves. If we are fighting on behalf of the 99%, we want them to speak up for themselves too. Yes, Catherine.
I think like so much of what everything has to do with is the fact that many people don't know their rights. And when you don't know your rights, you never learned your rights, you do not have the vocabulary. People have to learn new vocabulary. The Occupy people do, the 99% do, and the cops do. Everyone needs to learn to exercise new muscles.
Guys, there's a caller on the phone, but I'm going to ask that caller. My caller is my guest. So
yeah.
I'm going to ask my guest, Paul McIsaac, to hold on for a moment. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back for more on News Dissector Radio. I can't shut these people up. I can't stop them. You know, they say that, you know, change is irresistible and can't be stopped. Well, on this program, these speakers can't be tuned out and turned off. They're going to stay with us, I hope, for the rest of the program. Paul McIsaac is going to join us on the phone from somewhere on Long Island. We can't reveal where. Stay with us.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa. Yeah.
the sinless middle class. Corporate America's kicking our ass. Politicians' rhetoric filling the air, but they ain't doing nothing for the hungry and scared. It's all about the money they took from our towns, smiling and telling us it's coming around. We're over it. Yeah, we're over it. There's a revolution that's coming.
Hey, well, that's just a new song about Occupy. I'm listening to it for the first time, as you are. It's by Dale, the drummer for John Mellencamp, who's done this as a contribution. I think we're going to see a lot more music, a lot more culture emerging to support the Occupy movement. And one of the people who's been trying to do that in a very creative way is an old friend of mine and also a great producer and theater person, Paul McIsaacs, who's joining us from, somewhere in Long Island. And we're having a discussion here about the future of Occupy with some occupiers. We're having a little debate and a little discussion. But, Paul, what's been your take on this? Because you've been involved in movements going back into, the last century like I have.
The 19th century, yeah. Well, I've been working in the last few months with the trainers, people who do day-long trainings for Occupy. Lisa Fifian is kind of they call her, I think, the Professor Occupy. She's really comes out of Seattle and out of the global movement. She's a trainer and also a leader of direct action. And when Occupy first went down, she was called on by other people from the War Resisters League and other places. People wanted to get trained, and talk about tactics and the creation of affinity groups, different ways of working, legal questions, all of the things that surround taking, going into the street and taking direct action. And I went to and joined up with her because I've done training through the years like that. And we started talking about having a video which could be part of the training day, like a 30-minute video, which would be a history of direct action, nonviolent direct action. So I've been working on that, which means that I've been in the, as you often are, inside that universe of images and history and trying to revisit it constantly, go back and say, what does Gandhi have to do with today? What does Martin Luther King have to do with today? Or Sojourner Truth or whoever the movement in South Africa. And so I've been doing that work, and at the same time, of course, staying up on the actions and the debates, which are going on. And I have to say that I was reminded by doing that work that these debates are perennial. They will always be part of a people's movement because the fundamental questions, the moral questions, the political questions, the tactical questions, the personal questions about what constitutes actually doing something in the world instead of talking about it. And once you're doing something in the world, what constitutes doing it with others rather than some kind of, singular action? And when you're doing that with others, how do you respect each other? How do you work together to be successful? And then, of course, one of the most hotly debated items is what constitutes nonviolence. And there are many differences about that. And going back historically and looking at it, those debates will always come around because there are different situations and because people, really do have different interpretations of it. So it's been very lively and to be thinking about these questions again. And we're just in the last stages of finishing the video, which will be part of that training. So that's what I've been up to.
Paul, you've been working on a video, and I know it's not finished yet, but would you mind terribly if we just played a little bit of it
Sure.
on the air here? Because, this is an effort a movement that has, you know, kind of depth to it. It's not just like show up in the streets and, you know, and get your rocks off. This is about a movement that's very conscious, you know, of process, of working together, of trying to find democratic ways of resolving differences and reaching decisions. And, you know, that's something I think that's very impressive about it. And also why this movement has grown the way it has. You know, this, there have been a lot of, you know, radical movements for a long time that never got beyond 20 people and 40 opinions, you know, arguing with each other. And yet Occupy was able to bring together a diverse group of people, like the people in this radio station right now, with different backgrounds, different generations, different colors, different ideas, and yet those people were committed to working together. And you know, often the way the system prevails is it divides people. It doesn't allow for diversity. It increases suspicion among people and paranoia among people. And as a consequence, you end up with a situation where people are fighting each other rather than fighting against the system. And that is why, you know, this notion of training is so interesting, because the people participating in Occupy are involved in a process which includes realizing, like, I may not know everything. I may want to learn something from people who know more than I do. Catherine, you wanted to say something quickly. I want to play a little of Paul's.
One thing I think people really need to realize is that people are supposed to be different, and everyone ends up trying to make someone be exactly like them, which is like an impossible situation. So starting out with the first and foremost, you know, fact is that people are supposed to be different. They're supposed to have their different perceptions, and no two people are going to be exactly alike.
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, in the studio, you know, we have, you know, three examples of fantastic hair and me, you know. And, you know, Goldie started out with golden hair, and look at him today.
Yeah, this movement's wearing me down.
You know, it's gone gray. So, you know, we have these differences. But, Paul, let's listen to a little bit of this video, which is in the state. It's in a work in progress. And just to get at the idea of what you're going for. Okay, let's do that, Matt.
Suddenly, it seems people all over the world are in the streets demonstrating, occupying public spaces, committing civil disobedience. They're demanding social and political justice, an end to poverty, war, and environmental destruction. Some are challenging dictatorships, demanding elections, while others are saying elections are not enough, that they're rigged, corrupted, or controlled by the rich and powerful. These movements, often led by young people, face very different responses from their governments. Some officials restrain the police and respect the right to protest.
These are the goons of the 1%.
Others unleash a militarized police. Or in the worst cases, send in the army in a harsh and sometimes deadly response.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
In a few places, this repression has descended into civil war. But despite official violence, most people and their movements around the world remain committed to peaceful protest and nonviolent civil disobedience. This nonviolent movement has a long, sometimes forgotten tradition. This is a brief history. We know that people have always struggled against their oppressors, kings, rulers, bosses, those that have power and wealth and are willing to use violence to keep it. In this long struggle, people have resisted in any way they could. But over time, they have more and more turned away from violence. In the modern era, with the rise of democracies, people have fought for this right to vote, a nonviolent way to effect change. But in 1849, when only white men could vote in the United States, Henry David Thoreau wrote On the Duty of Civil Disobedience, arguing that voting was not enough. He argued that voting had not and could not end slavery, and that citizens had the responsibility to nonviolently break the law to end that evil, an idea far ahead of its time. But he and the other abolitionists could not stop the carnage of the Civil War. Sojourner Truth, born a slave, was among the first to link the American anti-slavery movement to the women's right to vote.
There is a band of women.
In the years that followed, women's worldwide struggle for the vote and equality became history's longest successful nonviolent movement, which included civil disobedience. At the beginning of the 20th century, women were joined by many in the labor movement to fight for the right to vote. But labor also had to turn to more direct actions, including strikes, sit-ins, and occupations. At this time in the British colony of South Africa.
Well, you know, I mean, we can go on here. Let's lose this for now. It's going to be a very powerful piece of work and an important piece of work, particularly, you know, for those generations that are not really familiar and not really taught about this history. You know, it's interesting, Goldie, to find that what you're doing today is within, you know, kind of a context of a history of the people who have gone before you, the people who have struggled, sometimes gotten killed, sometimes, but stood up for justice. And you seem to be, you know, part of this, the Occupy movement that didn't just come out of nowhere. It built on prior movements in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, we're a nonviolent movement because, I mean, we would lose in any violent confrontation anyway. The militarization of America is well beyond anything that went on in the 60s and, you know, it was bad in the 60s. So, you know, we have like the primary growth industry, which is violence in the U.S., being used against we have to go nonviolent because we can't compete with the violence of the American state.
Yeah, but sometimes isn't that hard to do, Paul or Priya? You know, isn't it hard, for example, to restrain yourself if somebody's beating you and somebody is attacking your friends and you're watching all of this? Don't you want to? Isn't it human nature to want to strike back?
First of all, you were talking about democracy in action, how we're practicing what we preach. We're manifesting, not just begging somebody to meet our demands, but actually doing it ourselves, manifesting our consensus, but also nonviolence. And yeah, of course, if my friend is getting beaten or I'm going to be on the receiving end of violence, self-defense is a birthright, and not being abused is definitely a human right. Having said that, I don't think we should lower ourselves, degrade ourselves by becoming violent. It won't be successful. It's probably suicidal. But at the same time, I'll give you an example. If I see a small child, for example, being abused by a parent or anybody, for me to say, oh, well, I'm going to be passive, not pacifist, just passive and not violent and interfere and let that child get abused, no, I would not feel good about that. And then I would bring to you a concept by Frantz Fanon, who wrote Wretched of the Earth, called revolutionary violence, which makes the point that sometimes stopping violence is preventing a greater violence from occurring.
And, okay, so you know, so you're summarizing in a way this debate that Paul was just referencing. Paul, what is your thinking about this? I mean, because you're supporting nonviolence not just for pragmatic reasons because it works, but because it also keeps our own humanity intact. You know, and Dr. King, and I had the privilege of meeting him and helping to be an organizer on the March on Washington in 1963, which suddenly surely dates me. You know, I'm not just in the 99%. I am 99%, I feel, sometime. But Paul, you're with me in that. You know, what is your take on this debate that's emerging here?
Well, my mind and my consciousness is just filled with this in a way it hasn't been in years because of what we're facing now and the resurgence of this centuries-long movement. And so I'm really filled with it, and it's very complicated, and I can stand on different sides of the argument at different moments. I will say a couple of things. One is that I don't, you know, I'm not a religious pacifist. I'm not an ethical pacifist. And I know that sometimes people take that kind of position, you know, you feel that they're taking it because they really don't want to do anything, or they're afraid of any kind of action. And that quietism is really a problem. You know, Gandhi actually said that he would prefer violence to inaction. Now, he was totally against violence, but he understood that not taking action in the face of corruption, in the face of oppression, was such an evil that he understood that people might take that stand. So, and I don't know that I think that Martin Luther King would have understood that as well. Is that, and he made many times he talked about the fact that he liked to quote Dante saying the worst place in hell is reserved for those people who don't take action in the face of wrong. So it's, but where we get, I think where it needs to be sparsed out a little bit and broken down a little bit is if we take the example, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name of the young woman who just spoke.
Priya Reddy.
Priya. You know, if we take just, and I think that we
do
actually.
Do you want her Bureau of Prison number?
I'm sorry. Prisons are violent.
I mean, just
the real,
you know,
violence
the fact
of the system.
Is
we wouldn't, shouldn't
theory,
focus
you
on.
Can theorize all day and kind of come up with, but I think it's very important to try to take actual examples so that you can learn from it, and that's why I do workshops. That's why I do training, because nobody stands around and makes speeches. You know, we actually get involved in real situations, or maybe pretend situations that help us think about it. So I guess what I would say is I completely agree. If I come upon someone abusing a child, you know, a parent abusing a child, to do nothing is the worst possible thing that I can do.
You know, yet at the same.
Let me just finish my thought. Can I not find a way to use my imagination, to use my creativity, to maybe bring humor to the situation, maybe get other people around to help me to not shame that parent, but to startle that parent out of what they're doing? That's what I think I would try to do, as opposed to actually intervening, because to actually intervene, to take my hand and put it on her to separate from the child, maybe in some cases the last resort in what you have to do, but usually there's 100 things you can do before you ever get to that
actually,
point.
Actually, on this point of humor, Paul, I wanted to tell people here about a video you did. I don't have it here right now in front of me, but maybe you can describe it to us. When it became clear that, you know, the police themselves were divided between the white shirts, the supervisors, the bosses of the police, and the regular cops, and that in many cases it was the white shirts, the supervisors who were organizing the violence rather than restraining the violence. So it's just
actually, that's the strategy of the police department, is to put them on the front line. That is what they made a decision in September, to put them up and do the arrests, and that was a conscientious decision. And watching that, I decided what I needed to do was to dress up as a white shirt in a comic way, with extra big stars and an extra big mustache, and I did the Halloween parade, which was right, of course. We did have a bunch of Occupy floats and stuff. And I walked around, and what it did to the police, the blue shirts were hysterical, because they, you know, it's a class system in the police department like every place else. And so they understood that I was playing this, you know, this loud, bumpus, noisy person. And the audience, of course, the people who were at the parade really understood. While you're on that point, you know, I was talking when I was playing that role, I was doing relating to Occupy. But the fact of the matter is, as an improvisational clown, I discovered that what was the most effective that this white shirt that I was playing could do was to bring up stop and frisk. And if I said to people there, black and white, you know, if I said to the crowd there, let me see your papers, they got hysterical. And they laughed so much, because that's such a huge issue in our city. Anyway, I just was saying yes, I think I agree completely that there are times and situations in which you're forced to maybe do, even take actions that you really don't want to do. But they are really way at the end of a whole long process. that has to do with creativity. You know, another, just a quick point, if I could.
Paul,
you know, going
Paul,
back through
Paul,
this history.
Paul, sorry. Paul, you're a director. I'm directing this conversation.
We're running
out of time. We have four minutes left in the show, and we don't have time. Everybody's going to get a chance to make a short, and I mean short, response here. But I want to give people the information about your website and Playback Theater, the work that you do. How do people reach you?
PlaybackNYC.com.
PlaybackNYC.com.
Yeah.
Paul McIsaac, you want to be in touch with this guy. You want to be involved with the work that they do.
Clowns are needed.
Particularly with young people. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. You can reach me at dissector@mediachannel.org. I write every day on newsdissector.net. That's my blog. PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com is the website of my films. Now, having said all this, I'm going to ask each person in this room to exercise tremendous discipline and give me one final prediction about what's going to happen with Occupy now that the weather has turned.
Well, I wanted to say satire. That's really important. We're talking about humor. We have to be able to flip this thing around and show it for how ridiculous it is. And like you said, summertime is here. It's March, and we're outside in T-shirts. I mean, people are going to be out in the streets everywhere. We're taking over spaces. We're talking. I think it's going to be a way more creative. That's what I'm looking for. And I wanted to just touch on Paul's point. Silence is violence. I don't have it written on my neck for no reason. If you don't stand up, that is violence.
Okay, Priya. A very short comment.
Paul, there are your papers. But seriously, stop and frisk Nazi Germany. There are parallels, but I would just like to leave you with this, which is the overwhelming violence of the system in terms of capitalism, prison, and wars. We should not lose sight of where this violence is coming from. And I don't know if you're going to like my thing that I in the Halloween parade 2 years ago was a papier-mâché guillotine, but you can reach me at OccupyRevolution@yahoo.com.
And tomorrow, just to let everybody know, is the next Occupy Town Square at Fort Greene Park in Brooklyn, 1 o'clock. Come down.
Okay, Goldie, last word.
Okay, Occupy is going to not only take a park, but we're also building the infrastructure to get the word out because we're going through gatekeepers right now in a propaganda state, and they'll never know what Occupy is about unless we tell them ourselves, and that's what we're going to do this year.
Yep. And that's what we're doing here on News Dissector Radio today. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. Thanks to Progressive Radio Network for hosting this show. We're going to leave you now. This is the part Catherine always hates the most because there's always another two seconds that we can use for more content, but we're going to have to leave it here. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops.
And bank walking, AAA,
Grandpa loses for